Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh?
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And today is an episode where we can call out a particular listener for suggesting it.
Yeah, listener Serena, she sent us this excellent Lifehacker article about why we feel the need to fill our pie holes and our eye holes with exaggerated versions of stimuli every day.
Yeah, and this started out because you think Lifehacker, you think, I'm reading a Lifehacker article and now I'm going to be able to better equipped to sort of make the best out of my day. You know, there's kind of an uplifting, you know, aspect to that. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know about you, but I entered into this topic with that sort of idea in mind. Like, oh, it's just a little quirky insight into how we go about our daily lives and maybe how we might improve it a little bit. But I found this topic to be one of the more ultimately disturbing topics that we've looked at, like this condemning of human nature, and sort of makes you want to crawl into a cave to a certain extent.
Yeah, because you're right. The premise was like, hey, we all love cheesecake, right? It's delicious. It's fatty. It's got tons of sugar. But this happens to be something called a supernormal stimuli. This is a term evolutionary biologists use to describe any stimulus that elicits a response stronger than the stimulus for which it evolved, even if it's artificial. Yes. So in other words, we like sugar because that's a quick hit of energy. We needed that back in the day. But we don't need a slice of cheesecake.
Yeah, sugar is probably the easiest example to just call out. And generally, not even really a harmless one, but a less harmful version than some of the things we're going to look at here. Because the basic idea is how much raw sugar can you find in the natural environment if you're a prehistoric hunter-gatherer? Mm-hmm. Maybe you'll find some berries. Maybe you'll find some sort of a carrot. But you're not going to find, a big sucker, a big dum-dum, a whole field of Tootsie Rolls to feast on. That is supernormal stimuli. That is a version of the stimuli that we seek as an organism, except it is blown out of proportion. It is the crack cocaine of sugar, and certainly crack and heroin, methamphetamines. These are other examples of super normal stimuli that have had a huge effect on humans.
Yeah, in my mind, there's a whole class of desserts called porn desserts.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about? Like those like 16-layer caramel cakes that are just so huge and big and with, you know, red frosting, and it's so over the top. And we'll be talking about porn, by the way,
yes,
later on. But it's like such a good example. Another great example of this sort of supernormal stimuli, giant-eyed dolls or even
yes,
anime characters.
I was thinking about this. Cute.
Yes.
We've recorded at least one podcast in the past on the power of cute and, mm-hmm. and how cute really taps into our primal instincts to want to care mm-hmm. for like a small child. And so we end up seeing that small child's face in a cat, in a cartoon character. But you look at some of these just super cute, hyper cute, dangerously cute anime characters or certainly the avatar of this Hello Kitty. And it's overpowering. It's cuteness almost beyond our human ability to take it in.
Right. And as Deidre Bartlett, a Harvard psychologist and the author of Super Normal Stimuli, How Primal Urges Overran Their Evolutionary Purposes, says, this human instinct for food, sex, or even territorial protection, all of that is rooted in our instincts evolved, as you say, for hunting and gathering in early man. And she says that evolution has been unable to keep up with the pace of change, this rapid change in the modern life in which a Taco Bell, Doritos, Loco Taco, you know, Dayglo mm-hmm. orange in your hand suddenly arrives. Our bodies and our minds aren't really unable to water down that instinct, that response to that food or that stimulus.
Yeah, I mean, because on a basic level, what does the human creature need in order to survive? It needs to mate and reproduce. It needs to take in food. It needs to find these various tastes that please it. It needs protection. It doesn't need a lot of things. But then we layer on all the complexities of human civilization, mm-hmm. our technology, our art, our ability to find all the stimuli that we crave and then just pump them up to an unbelievable degree.
Yeah, Bartlett says that as a result, we have a glut of larger-than-life objects, from candy to pornography to atomic bombs that cater to outmoded but persistent drives with dangerous results.
Indeed. Now, in order to fully understand this, we have to go to the roots of the term supernormal stimuli, which are based in some rather simple biological principles, which is nice because, again, all these human layers of human civilization and technology, it complicates the issue. But when we look to the animal world, we can find a far simpler model. And we find that back in the 1930s with the work of Dutch Nobel laureate Nico ten Bergen.
That's right. He is the person who coined the term supernormal stimuli to describe these sort of imitations that appeal to primitive instincts and exert stronger attraction than the real thing. So this biologist, he set about isolating traits that trigger certain instincts in animals and insects. And he manipulated these traits in nature to see what would happen. So this next bit is from the Life Hacker article by Daniel Jody, or Giotti, I suppose. It says that he constructed plaster eggs to see which one a bird would prefer to sit on, finding that they would select those that were larger, had more defined markings, or more saturated color. A Dayglo bright egg with black polka dots, for instance, would be selected over the bird's own pale, dappled eggs. And in fact, that bird would keep slipping off the huge one, but mm-hmm. it couldn't help it. It was drawn to that super stimuli of the colors and the markings.
Because the colors and the markings in the natural world, in the natural course of events, would indicate the healthier eggs, which ones have the highest rate of survival, and therefore that's where the bird is going to focus its attention. This artificial egg, though, just pumps that completely out of proportion, and the bird cannot help but respond by setting on this lifeless but beautiful gaudy egg and riding that egg to the detriment of its actual biological offspring in the surrounding eggs, which are okay, but less amazing.
Yeah, this is actually, to me, the really depressing part when you see this in nature.
Yes.
Because it really does bear out this idea that a lot of this is sort of hardwired in us and all organisms. He also found that territorial male stickleback fish would attack a wooden fish model more vigorously than a real male if its underside was redder. So again, pumping up those signs to it that would make it say, oh, that's a competitor.
Yes.
Look how red that underbelly is.
And this is interesting, too. I want to make sure everyone sort of bookmarked this for later. Here we have supernormal stimuli that is in kind of in the negative realm as opposed to the positive, something that's based in fear as opposed to desire.
That's a really good point, the aggressive part of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, another experiment was that he constructed a cardboard dummy butterfly with more defined markings that male butterflies would actually try to mate with in preference to actual real female butterflies.
And that's another one to definitely remember for later when we start getting into the human versions of these same principles.
Yeah, because if you think about, we'll get into this later, but you know, I always talk about gender performance and, mm-hmm. okay, if you take a female and a male and you don't do really much to them in terms of grooming them and clothing them in ways that are coded for their gender, there's not a ton of difference between them. But if you slap on a bunch of makeup on a female, pluck her eyebrows, she's really performing that gender. And I think about it that with these butterflies, like this must have been like the Marilyn Monroe of that butterfly.
Yes.
And all the other male butterflies were like, yes, that one, even though she's wooden, looks great.
Yes, the butterfly becomes this, a little closer to this ideal butterfly, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what really gets me about the topic of supernormal stimuli. My mind in reading this kept returning to Plato's theory of forms. Plato is in the philosopher, of course. He proposed that we live in this material realm, right? Okay, and beyond our plane of existence, there's an immaterial realm of ideal forms. All right, you can think of these ideal forms as the absolute perfection of a given thing, a truth that cannot be manifested in the material world. All we can do is echo it, okay? So in this world, there's no true beauty. But we have an innate understanding and longing for the true form of beauty as it exists beyond the limits of the material world. In a similar sense, you would argue that there's no true justice here, but we all have a sense of justice because there's an unreachable ideal that exists beyond our realm, okay, out there in the realm of forms. And you can apply this to just about anything. One argument that's often made is a chair. Like, every chair in our world is just a take, an attempt to capture the perfect chairness that we would find in the world of forms beyond our material world. Every pretty face, every feeling, every work of art, it's just a take on the ideal. And so it's tempting to view a supernormal stimuli in the same way. We innately long for the true forms, forms that simply do not occur in the natural world. We do it through our art and our technology. And in doing this, we're able to inch a little closer and a little closer to this awesome and terrible perfection that we crave. And so we end up inching closer and closer in creating an artificial thing that just cannot exist in this world. And we're craving nothing but shadows of that and imitations of that. And we're taking, and to your point, that, I mean, the makeup argument is perfect because we're taking real versions of beauty and, in a sense, defacing them and trying to carve them into avatars of this true form, this perfect form that just cannot be achieved.
Yeah, this is essentially the Platonic ideal, right? This idea that you're trying to get to this ideal as close to perfection as possible, although what Plato would say there's no perfection because we are mere copies of what God intended, right?
Right.
So there's this obsession with, as you say, perfection and idealism, and that the supernormal stimuli is really a stand-in for it. It's such an intriguing idea, especially when we get to another section in which we talk about porn and other things that other types of media that we consume. But before we do that, let's take a break. And when we get back, we are going to talk about why humans are essentially like seagull chicks when it comes to art.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend, or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back. We are going to revisit this topic, art, and why we're drawn to it. Because we did a podcast on this, I believe it was like The Science of Beauty or along those lines. Mm-hmm. And we talked about V.S. Ramachandran, who has some really great and interesting ideas about art that he says that are hardwired to the way that we respond to our environments. And particularly, he says, we evolved in a camouflage environment and we are rewarded when we identify objects and patterns. And that's why we like to seek them out so often in this idea called grouping. So he says that when you are looking at a artwork, you can't help but be pleased on some level if you can detect those patterns. Now, he says to really understand why we are drawn to certain works of art, you have to look at seagull chicks, because when they hatch, they start pecking at the mother's beak for food. And the mother seagull's beak is a long yellow thing with a red spot on the end. So for those chicks, that red spot is that kind of stimuli that they know if they tap it, they get food.
Right.
So action, reaction, and reward.
But what researchers quickly found is that you have, okay, so you have the beak with the markings, but you can have just a beak. You don't need the mother because the, because nature takes shortcuts in our associations here, or and certainly in the associations of birds. So you can take the mother out of the equation. You can just put an, a beak on a stick, mm-hmm. and they will respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the,
but it
has the first
to have that
level.
Red spot on.
Yes, it has to have the spot. Has to have the appropriate markings. But where it gets even crazier is that you turn those markings into super stimuli. You put three red lines on there.
Mm-hmm.
And then that just makes it irresistible to the chick. Like, it just overflows the circuitry, overloads the circuitry, and they have to go to that beak now.
Yeah, and actually, Ramachandran says that the chick prefers the fetishized, highly abstract representation of a beak to the real beak. Again, a little depressing here because
yeah.
the mother is attached to the real beak. And yet, here are these three stripes that are very strong. They're exhibiting a crazy reaction to, and this was research done by ethologist Tim Burton, by the way.
Yeah, not to be confused with the Tim Burton.
No.
Yeah, I was trying to, because I was reading the interview with Ramachandran and he referred to Tim Burton, so I started doing all these searches for Tim Burton birds, Tim Burton biologist, and it was still getting nothing but information on the director, Tim Burton.
That's too bad, because I would love to see some sort of mashup, like him directing a film about supernormal stimuli.
Yeah. I mean, I feel I want to see nothing but films about supernormal stimuli now. Super stimuli about super stimuli.
Indeed. But Ramachandran says that this is the same reason that we humans gravitate toward art, that these abstractions, these metaphors, and unusual combinations of elements play to instincts wired deep in our reptilian brains, instincts that really don't have any bounds. Because again, as Bartlett says, everything that's available to us today
mm-hmm.
in the supersized fashion is not something that was available, 10,000 years ago. And so our brains and our bodies just have not been able to be conscious enough really to tamp this down.
Yeah. And I love how he referred to the artificial beak for the bird as a fetish, because it instantly brings to mind some of these ancient fetishes that you see the Venus figurines,
mm-hmm.
right, where it's generally like almost a headless woman, bosoms and belly, and in a sense, even in a very primitive sense, this is an idealized female form. And of course, through the history of art, you see lots of idealized versions of the female form. I mean, the Venus de Milo, for example, is just another Venus in a very long tradition of Venuses.
Well, yeah, I mean, the code of those pieces of art is basically that your genetic material is going to survive better in this person, maybe, because
yeah.
perhaps there will be stronger offspring or more of a chance to copulate with this person, or
mm-hmm.
I mean, those are all the signs that are coming from that particular piece of art. And Ramachandran says that artists are tapping into the figural primitives of our perceptual grammar and creating ultra normal stimuli that are more powerfully exciting certain visual neurons in our brains as opposed to realistic looking images.
Yeah, like when we did our podcast on art, savannas came up, landscapes.
Yeah.
That there are certain artistic interpretations of landscapes that arguably get into our brain more.
That are more pleasing.
More pleasing, but essentially get their claws into us
mm-hmm.
because on a very primitive level, we see it and we know that this would be a good place to live. It's like, oh, there's some trees, I can seek some cover there. There's some water I can drink. Everything that Bob Ross describes when he's painting a landscape,
mm-hmm.
like those are all things that are, those are all aspects of a landscape that would be pleasing to the human organism.
Yeah, I remember from that too that the vantage point was really important, that you would want to be up on a hill in
yes.
those landscape paintings so that you would be able to see out, not just, over your kingdom, but be able to see any intruders coming upon you.
Right. All right, so that's art. It's one thing to think about the aesthetic world, but how do we take this and apply it to the less aesthetic worlds of, say, fast food?
Well, as we had mentioned before, especially with sugar, our bodies need a little bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have, those big, crazy anime eyes looking at that
right.
and taking all of that in and thinking, I want the entire thing. So, for me, I think this topic is really writ very large in junk food.
Yes.
Because food is energy. We gravitate to it. But we don't necessarily know when to stop, right? That's that whole boundary thing with our instincts. So if you look at a giant jar of peanut butter on a shelf, you know, I'm talking about Costco or any of those other like super crazy places where they've got just giant oversized cans of all types of food.
Yeah.
On some level, that's tapping into the primal brain. And somewhere, I mean, you know, some evolutionary biologists might say, that jar of peanut butter is a promise to you that you're not going to have to leave your cave very often for food and you won't encounter as much danger.
Yeah, because your body is saying, that stuff is great. That is what I crave. I want as much of that as we can possibly get so that I can stockpile it and have it whenever I want.
I will not have to leave my apartment for 3 months with that jar of peanut butter. But, you know, of course, there's an idea here that we live so much in the symbolic world.
Yeah.
So some of these meanings can't help but drill down into us.
You know, I can't help but think of French fries in terms of supernormal stimuli, because what are French fries? Your average order of French fries, you know, covered with ketchup, and that's not counting if you're adding bacon or chili or nacho cheese or whatever the latest TGI Fridays sort of twist on it happens to be. But in one plate, you're satisfying your cravings for fat, for crispiness that you're on one level associating with fresh vegetables. You're getting sweetness, you're getting salt, maybe you're getting a hint of meat if you have some sort of weird topping on it, and all of this in one big blasphemous serving.
You know what's really interesting about that is there is an article out there somewhere about the physics of a potato chip and why it's so appealing to us. And if I'm remembering this correctly, the kind of crunch, that popping sound that the chips make is the exact same that a fresh fruit or vegetable might feel like in your mouth. And this is something that our brains have been tagging for, you know, tens of thousands of years. And so that chip is really just riding into the circuitry of your brain saying, fresh.
Fresh. This is good. This is healthy. We cannot just eat just one. Eat the whole bag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's salty too.
Yeah. All right, another area that, again, there's a level of aesthetics involved in this as well, but the world of gaming, video gaming. Everything from, you know, playing, what is it, Candy Crush on your phone to some sort of deep MMO immersion experience. Because what do you get with video games? You get an instant entry into a world of goal achievement.
Yes.
Neurological award for that goal achievement, empowerment, in some cases graphic violence, exploration. The goal achievement is something I often think about when I find time these days to play like a quick video game. Like I think, well, this is clearly what's happening here is my brain is adjusting to this false environment and saying, oh, well, we just achieved something there. We just achieved something there. Even if in the course of the day, maybe I didn't actually close any loops, you know? Here I am closing loop after loop in just, say, 15 minutes of gameplay.
So this reminds me of two things. One is the stickleback fish, right? Because you've got the red underside of the wooden fish, the more aggression toward that. And video games are so beautiful, if I may say that. The way that they're rendered and the colors and the saturation, all of that is very intriguing and it's kind of like hyper-realism. So that's one thing I think that people fall into. The other is, this is really playing into for me, is an episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And are you familiar with this?
Yes, yeah, I've watched a number of episodes. Oh, it's good.
It's great. And one of the characters is Dee, and she's kind of always shoved around by the other guys in this gang of theirs, so to speak. And she turns to the virtual world with avatars to try to vanquish them in a sense. Because in real life, she has not much power or control over the situation, but she creates these characters and everybody in the town gets to know the virtual reality players in this game, get to know that gang, and they know how Dee is describing them in this other world. It is probably my favorite It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia episode, and there's this great idea behind it all that they're just all in a turtle's dream in outer space.
Oh, that's pretty awesome. I'll have to check that episode out.
Yes.
I love that you mentioned the word avatar, because certainly avatar in the gaming world is one thing. It's the version of us that goes into this lesser world. And in the world of cosmology and religion, an avatar is a version of a god that we as humans can interact with, or at least some aspect of a god that we can comprehend. And in thinking about the ideal forms of Plato, I can't help but think of those forms in that ideal realm as being kind of like gods, kind of like a pantheon of gods, where each deity is, again, an idealized version of something that we want out of life. And in the gaming world, this adversary that you're shooting in this 15 minutes of gameplay in the evening, that is the ideal version of an adversary, kind of an avatar of some ideal enemy, and you're vanquishing it. In the same way that this artificial version of a beautiful woman in a magazine is, again, an avatar of ideal beauty that we've created, some version of the unimaginable perfection beyond our realm that we have made, we've cobbled together in our realm.
Ooh, let's jump off on that, because I think the beautiful woman thing that really plays into this idea of porn and, again, gender performance. And when we talked about lust in an episode of one of our Seven Sins, we talked about this article called The Internet is for Porn, so let's talk about it. And I just wanted to reference it real quick in light of why we seek supernormal stimuli. In 1991, before ye old internet, I suppose by now, there were fewer than 90 porn magazines published in the U.S. Today, more than 2.5 million porn sites are blocked by CyberSitter. That's not all of them, but that's as many as CyberSitter has combed through. So now consider that porn is tapping into the reward circuitry of your brain with the release of dopamine. And dopamine is really that neurotransmitter, that chemical that keeps you seeking out that experience again and again. It's what helps form habits.
Mm-hmm.
So porn is this kind of really interesting aspect of supernormal stimuli, because, you know, you could have a person in the other room who is more than willing to have sex with you, mm-hmm. but some people will actually opt to say, just look at porn instead. And, interact with that image in their mind. And that is fascinating, because here you might have the real thing, but, you know, just like the beak, mm-hmm. the fake beak with the three stripes on it, you keep sort of going toward that fake thing.
Or even more to the point, like the gaudy golden egg in the bird's nest.
Yeah.
It's not going to produce anything. It has no substance. It's just a gateway to the abyss. But you're going to choose that over actual human interaction. Or at least even the, because certainly not everyone's in a position where they can as easily find human interaction and ultimately some sort of sexual experience. But still, to choose that over the attempt at it, the attempt at human interaction.
And think about that egg again, mm-hmm. you know, the big, giant egg with the spots on it, the polka dots, and it's day glow yellow. And then think about the women that are represented in porn and their dimensions. Quite often you have, I don't know that there's even any porn that features women that aren't augmented or at least approaching certain dimensions with their bodies.
Well, there are a lot of different types of pornography.
Obviously 70s porn.
I'll tell you what, Patton Oswalt, the stand-up comedian, he did a bit, and I imagine still does a bit, pointing out that no matter what one's, like, whatever a person's particular individual fetish is, no matter, you know, this dark thing that they haven't told anybody, somewhere out there in the world, there is a team of people who have a magazine devoted to that and are just so bored with it. It's just so every day. Now, this is an older bit that he did. I imagine you could basically extrapolate this to websites and just pornography in general. So, but every corner of sexuality, within limits, or maybe not even within limits, is represented out there. And that's part of the supernormal stimuli of it. Like, you could just go out there and just fall down the hole of pornography mm-hmm. and almost never reach the bottom.
And again, dopamine would be really helping to carve out those neural pathways mm-hmm. to keep you going again and again. So, obviously, we are conscious of our behavior. We humans, we have that beautiful prefrontal cortex, which is helping us manage all these different things about our lives and helping us be conscious. So how do we want to look at this? Because, I mean, you can look at this in a light of like, a positive
super,
light.
Supernormal stimuli in general or just pornography?
Basically, supernormal in general.
Because with pornography, we could certainly go a lot deeper into that topic and just discussing, like, because you have supernormal stimuli, and then how does that affect just everything in life? How does that affect, you know, underlying currents of misogyny in culture? How does that affect your personal interactions, your expectations from real-world sexuality? How does it change real-world sexuality? But it's for another podcast.
I guess what I'm saying is there are two different ways to look at this. So you want to take good cop or bad cop?
I guess I'll take bad cop.
Knew it. Okay.
Okay. Well, I mean, the bad cop version of looking at the supernormal stimuli is that, I mean, we're kind of boned, and we always have been. We're tied to these cravings and these desires for these ideal forms. And we, thanks to our technology, thanks to our art, we're able to sort of scratch away at that layer between us and the ideal to create these artificial versions of the things we want. And then we're kind of powerless to resist them. You know, we end up not leaving our apartments because the internet provides us just instant access to whatever our whim might be. Instant access to just, you know, an endless stream of whatever kind of sexuality we want to immerse ourselves in. We can order any kind of tantalizing junk food we want and have it delivered right to our home in whatever quantities we want. And so we end up just setting on that big golden egg, just riding it into extinction. Like the atomic bomb at the end of Dr. Strangelove. And indeed, the atomic bomb is an example
of aggression,
mm-hmm. of super stimuli in the world of protection and the desire to be protected against aggression from these outsider forces.
Okay, I'll add one thing to that before I go to good cop.
Okay.
All right.
See, because you're a bad cop, too. That's the thing.
Well, I can be a good cop.
Yeah.
Do you remember when we were talking about our episode on habits?
Yes.
And we were talking about like something like 45% of the decisions that we make on a daily basis are rooted in habit.
Mm-hmm.
And if habits are driven by reward systems, then that means that that's not such a great thing, right? Like
right.
It would be very hard for us to overcome these sort of routinized neural pathways that are happening every single day. Like, you might have to be as zen as a monk and as conscious of your behaviors. But now I will go to Deidre Bartlett.
Okay.
She's really the good cop here. And she says, humans have one stupendous advantage over Tinbergen's birds. That's Nicholas Tinbergen. She says, we have a giant brain, and this would give us the unique ability to exercise self-control and override instincts that lead us astray and extricate ourselves from civilization's gaudy traps. You think so? You think we can do it?
Maybe. I mean, it's kind of a colossal idea because, again, I kind of like to look at these super stimuli entities as kind of dark gods from beyond our universe. And then what do we have to combat them? We have a nice brain. We have some willpower that we can summon. We have some self-knowledge of our relationship with super stimuli. We can conceivably stop and realize, oh, that even without getting into to porn, to go back to just beauty, you know, to realize, oh, well, that version of Scarlett Johansson that's on the front of that magazine is actually, she's wearing makeup. She has probably been photoshopped. Like, even though that is a real woman, that is an idealized version of a real woman. So we can be self-aware. We can exert willpower. So, yeah, I will agree with the good cops to a certain extent on that. But I feel like we're up against some pretty overwhelming odds.
No. We like to rely on our lazy blueprint that we've created mm-hmm. for ourselves. Or at least I should say I do.
Because back to willpower, we've done, of course, podcasts on willpower. And we know that willpower is a depletable resource. So when we're most in command of ourselves, when we're most awake and aware of ourselves, then maybe we're the equal of this of these forces. But we can't stay awake all the time. We can't stay completely tanked up on willpower all the time.
Unless we have a third eye that we can open to consciousness. But I think that kind of concludes where we are with this topic.
I think so.
You know, there are a couple of bright spots in this world in which symbolic meaning is underpinning everything that we do.
Indeed. We have the equipment to fight the good fight, so just keep that in mind.
Suit up.
Yeah, the next time cheesy fries come at you. All right. Obviously, this is a topic that everyone is going to have experience with on multiple levels, so we would love to hear from just about everybody on it. You can get in touch with us a number of ways. Of course, as always, go to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is the mothership. That is where you'll find all the podcast episodes and our latest blogs, videos, links out to the social media accounts that we use. And speaking of those, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Tumblr, we're on Google+. On YouTube, we are Mind Stuff Show, and you can subscribe there to stay on top of our latest videos.
Yep, and if you have some strong feelings about, like, what sort of super stimuli makes you go, ayuga, you know, with the big cartoon eyes that come out of your head,
yeah.
Let us know. You can send us an email at blowthemind@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Eugene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.